Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motieka, your host for an hour of medical news, debate, discussion, healthcare, and science in the news, and your opinions and mine here on KUSP. Before we go any further, let me remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Well, we take a big deep breath. We've gotten through the first of the holiday hurdles, and now we can all go take a long, brisk walk and maybe try to reboot our systems after a day that seems to be, well, let's just say it's a day of excess and leave it at that. However you want to define it, it's over. And life can get back to normal. So getting back to normal with the email, I have a lot of email here, and I'm going to start off with that. Later on in the show, I have some advice for those with knee pain, and it may not be what you think it is. Let's start off with a question from Tom in Missouri. A few weeks ago, on October 31st, you mentioned that iodine will get the attention that vitamin D is getting today. I just read a similar view from a cardiologist that said that the healthiest people are the most likely to be iodine deficient because they avoid salt, minimize meat eating, and exercise. When you read on iodine supplements, there are all these warnings on dose level and negative impacts. Can you expand on your thoughts? I.e., is it safe to take a couple of kelp tablets a day? Who should supplement? And are there negatives to supplements like kelp because of arsenic, etc.? Well, Tom, it's an excellent question. And let me start out with just saying that the pendulum in medicine and in science swings back and forth. And the truth is always somewhere there in the middle. And in fact, we are, because of the speed of the pendulum as we move past the center on we're moving so fast, we don't even see that we've arrived at the truth before we've gone past it and have gone out to the other extreme. The warnings that you currently see on iodine are really, really not science-based. They date back to 1960s medical textbooks, which is what the people who are currently writing the warnings were trained from. But if you go back to the 1920s and 1930s in America, there was a truly massive use of iodine in the opposite direction. So people were receiving what, well, now would be considered truly massive doses of like 50 milligrams of iodine a day. And just FYI for perspective, the current minimum daily requirement is 150 micrograms. And that's the amount that keeps you from getting a goiter, which is an enlargement of your thyroid caused by there not being enough iodine in your diet. So your thyroid responds to feedback loops by enlarging, trying effectively to produce enough thyroid hormone. Goiters were absolutely epidemic in the United States up until about the 1920s. And the reason for that was that the soil is very iodine deficient, particularly in the Midwest of the United States. So the great idea that was one of the early kind of FDA successes was, well, let's put iodine in the salt because people use salt and then we'll be supplementing them and everyone will stop getting goiters. And that did work. It was based, of course, on the amount of salt that people were then consuming, which was quite a bit higher than the current amount. So the comment by the cardiologist that the healthiest people are most likely to be iodine deficient is accurate. But he makes it sound like it's healthy to be iodine deficient in this letter, and in fact, that's not the case. I think doses, most naturopathic physicians would agree with that, and I think a lot of people who actually look at the scientific literature would have no trouble with this statement, that somewhere around 1 to 3 milligrams a day of iodine is a very appropriate amount. It can be found in the natural diets of many wild-type humans on the planet, and they seem to be doing just fine with it. There are no reports at all of complications in treating people with iodine at this level. That being said, some people have side effects if they jump onto a high dose or medium dose of iodine. If they're deficient, their body may not do that well going directly to 3 milligrams. So I recommend that people titrate up. The problem that Tom in Missouri raises about whether or not there are problems with supplements because of contamination is an excellent one. We do have to worry about contamination. And in fact, ironically, if you were to take a large group cohort, which has been done, I don't have the reference at my fingertips, but I can get it for anybody who wants to challenge me on this. If you take a look at women who take supplements, the more health food store supplements you take, the higher your body lead level is. And that presumably is because you're getting some lead contamination in the supplements. We know from independent studies that lead contamination in supplements does occur. It occurs more frequently than lead contamination in pharmaceuticals, because the pharmaceutical companies are required to check, and the supplement companies, well, it's up to them. So thanks, Tom, for the interesting email. And we have a call that we're going to go right to, and that's Jane in Carmel. Hello, Jane. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a situation where my husband has been diagnosed with atopic dermatitis, and the only thing that seems to work is prednisone to relieve the itching, which it comes from a lot of little red spots all over his body.
I'm sorry, what kind of rash, what they give him as a diagnosis?
Atopic dermatitis.
Okay, go ahead.
Kind of eczema, apparently.
Right, all right, thank you.
And what I want to know is, when he takes the prednisone, it seems to relieve the itching and reduce the number of new spots. The indication is that you're only supposed to take it for 4 days.
How old is he?
73.
Is he taking any non-steroidal anti-inflammatories like ibuprofen or naproxen?
No. Only occasionally.
Only occasionally. Okay. Any history of asthma?
No.
Okay. What about allergies, like hay fever?
No.
Okay.
I actually have them worse than he does.
All right. Well, let me just start off by saying that atopic dermatitis is the disease of children. So if a person gets to be 70 and has not had asthma, doesn't have hay fever or allergies, and didn't have childhood eczema, I am so in doubt of the accuracy of his diagnosis.
Yeah.
Just from the get-go. You're either an atopic individual or you're not, and that manifests itself quite early. So this is a secondary acquired problem, and it's showing up as a rash which resembles atopic dermatitis, by which I would infer that the rash is caused by immune complexes, which is to say little antibodies are grabbing onto something, and these antibody something complexes are depositing in the skin and setting off an immune response. That's the Cliff's Note version. And you, believe me, you only want the Cliff's Note version on this because it's obscenely complicated. What do you do about that? Well, you try to figure out what on earth he's reacting to. Most 70-year-olds in our culture are taking at least 3 pharmaceuticals on the average. So I would, first of all, try to remove or eliminate drugs, and I would probably put him on a low antigen diet. In other words, take out the most common food substances that cause rashes and cause immune reactions. That's called an elimination diet. There are many of those available online. You can also contact me at my office on Mission Street, and I'll help you get a hold of a decent elimination diet. But the trick is getting the person to actually go off of all of the foods, because it contains some common things like wheat and dairy. And so, you know, getting a 70-year-old to change their ways, well, it depends on the 70-year-old. But if you could promise him not having to take prednisone and he only has to do it for 3 weeks, you might pull it off. But anyway, I would look at drugs and foods and herbs as things that are going into the mouth that are conceivably causing his rash. And I would think that there is something there in that department.
And meanwhile, what are the dangers of taking prednisone 4 days?
For 4 days, your main issue is going to be getting exposed to an influenza or even a bad cold while your immune system is suppressed. Over the long term is greater than 10 days. Prednisone causes changes in the adrenal gland, and a person who has to take it for a month, for example, will have a sluggish adrenal gland. If they are then challenged in any way, let's say they fall down a flight of stairs and break their leg, they're much more likely to go into shock because they don't have the stress hormone. Their adrenal gland can't pump out enough of the stress hormones to support them at a period of high stress.
Yeah,
I see.
So it's a pretty powerful drug.
Yes, and there's also all these other side effects. The older you are, the more likely it is to make you diabetic, the more likely you are to develop osteoporosis. These are wonder drugs, and wonder drugs have wonderful effects and wonderful side effects.
Right.
So I'm afraid in the short run, it'll relieve his symptoms, but it's a little bit like getting the mosquito with the flamethrower. Also, it doesn't do anything about the mosquitoes. Putting up screen doors might... Sorry, I'm really... That's kind of a lame metaphor. So I'm going to stop right now.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
All right, bye-bye. Bye.
I'm going to jump now to Kelly in Plattsburgh, New York. Question about migraines. I'm 46 and have had migraines for as long as I can remember. Recently, they have become more frequent and more severe. My last bout of them lasted for over 2 weeks, where I fought them every day during that time. I have a husband and two teenage boys who are very supportive. These migraines are very debilitating, and I get very discouraged with my attempts at addressing them. I've tried amitriptyline and Topamax, and am now on Norvasc. Parentheses, my blood pressure is low to begin with. I am doing medical massage and have an appointment with a neurologist this week. I just started a sinus rinse, since this is often where I feel the pain very intensely. I've tried acupuncture and feel that this may help, but I need to find someone good in our area. I'm doing Revival Soy daily and have found this greatly helps my hot flashes. Yes, lucky me, I'm perimenopausal with severe migraines. If you can give any more info, I've analyzed this to death. Thank you for any help you can offer. And I wanted to throw this one out because it resonates nicely with the previous call, the woman whose husband had the atopic dermatitis, and that's looking for food triggers. Migraines notoriously are related to food triggers, and so it's extremely important to think about those and to also maybe do one of these low antigenic diets just as a, you know, just for fun. Change your diet to something that's very low impact, rice and vegetables and maybe poultry, and take out all the processed foods and just go for a few weeks and see if your chronic symptoms disappear and if you feel better. Then you reintroduce things one by one. And as you reintroduce, you wait a few days each time and maybe you're going to find that, oh my goodness, my nasal congestion came back after I had peanut butter. And wouldn't that be a useful thing to know? With respect to chronic headaches, also vitamin B6 and feverfew, which is an herb, are very helpful, and I use them a lot in my practice. The feverfew contains a compound called parthenolides, and these are very helpful in stabilizing vascular headaches. And I'm taking Kelly at her word here that her migraines are in fact a vascular headache and not just a code word for very severe headaches, because in our culture, sometimes people use the word migraine to mean very bad headache that makes me want to throw up. That's a very bad headache that makes you throw up. It may or may not be a true vascular headache. Yet another email also on headaches. We're having lots of internal resonance today. This one from Kevin in Santa Cruz. Would like suggestions regarding how to overcome or cure regular headaches. Symptoms, headaches primarily on the top and the back of my head, occurs regularly, typically when I'm lying down with the back of my head resting on a pillow or doing stressful activities. Probably computer related would be my guess. Cannot rid headache with aspirin or other medication, sometimes will last for hours, but seems to get better when I'm standing or upright. Sometimes will be very transitory. Have tried acupuncture and deep tissue massage with minor, if any, results. MRI shows cervical stenosis with doctor's diagnosis that nerves may be aggravated and causing the headaches. Doctors suggested remedies to date, cortisone injections or surgery. I do not like the idea of either of these for fear of resulting paralysis or further damage to my neck and spine. Suggestions, please. Okay. Well, Kevin, I do have some suggestions. First of all, if your pain is so radically, or rather I should say, so temporally related to pressure on the back of your neck and the back of your scalp, my first thought is occipital neuritis or occipital nerve irritation. And yes, this could be related to a superior spinal stenosis, something very high up in the neck. You didn't, unfortunately, give me the level in your MRI, but if it were C2, C3, that would certainly be high enough to trigger or contribute to an occipital neuritis. The other thing about occipital neuritis is that you can establish whether it's causing your headaches with a very simple, very safe treatment called an occipital nerve block. This nerve comes out at the base of your skull in the back, and it wraps like a tree root around the back part of your skull, all over the occipital lobe. A physician can infiltrate a little bit of lidocaine, the same agent or Marcaine, the same agents that are used for dental analgesia, and take that nerve down for, say, 6 to 8 hours as a test. So if you're having a headache or you've got these symptoms that are reproducible, you block the occipital nerve and your symptoms are alleviated, then you've identified a locale that I would be very comfortable saying can be safely injected with steroids if you decided to go that route. Although sometimes just the local anesthetic will be very helpful. This is one of those places where it can be multiple factors contributing. So looking at your posture, looking at how you hold your body when you're under stress, and is the stress generated by your workstation or where your computer setup is, because that's a very common one. But trying to eliminate at least one of the multiple factors, you know, you eliminate the one you can reach. And sometimes that can make a huge difference, particularly for frequent headaches. And we're going to Elizabeth in Monterey. Hello, Elizabeth, and welcome to the program.
Yes, good morning. This is about migraines.
Go ahead.
I'm 76 years old. Must be a rarity because I take no medications at all or vitamins or anything like that. This summer, I had a string of migraines. I've had them over the years and controlled them with diet, as you suggest. But then this summer, I had the mother of all migraines that lasted a couple weeks. And I examined my diet, went on the internet, and found a lot of information about tyramines. And
right.
I'm going to ask you to give a comment, but I did discover that bananas and avocados are very high in tyramines. And there were some other things that were very high that I had started to incorporate in my diet. And the thing is about migraines, I've discovered with myself, is I might go for 8 months without a migraine, and by then I've totally forgotten why I don't eat certain foods. And then I think, oh, I haven't had bananas for a long time, or something like that. But now I've been really, really careful, and I haven't had a migraine since August. And that was when I was really wiped out. You know, I had never had one that lasted for like 7 or 8 days, but they're horrible. But I think this whole idea of check your diet.
Yes.
You know, and maybe you could comment on the tyramines.
Sure. Tyramine is what we call a vasoactive substance, and it causes blood vessels to dilate, and they're really the two common ones are tyramine and phenylethanolamine, which are both found in foods, and bananas definitely are on the list. My list does not include avocados, but that was interesting information. Some other things, red wine. Aged cheese, chicken
Absolutely.
Liver.
Absolutely, yes.
Chicken liver, which is found in a lot of sausages.
Oh, yes, yeah, because I was thinking, oh, I need some zinc in my diet, mm-hmm. and I discovered chicken livers have zinc.
Right.
So I did a little stir fry with, you know, mushrooms and onions.
Just a little, and bam. Pickled herring, that's another one. Any kind of sausage or processed meat, sour cream, chocolate, bananas, pork, even pork. And
Yes, these are things that are common.
Right. And other things can be triggers. So other common substances are nitrites, which are used in food preservation and also sometimes sprinkled on the salad bar to keep the salad bar green.
Right, yeah.
And
wine.
Are they
in wine? No,
they are
definitely.
The sulfites are also a trigger, though.
The white
and
wine.
And alcohol can do it. Some people will have a reaction to aspartame, which is NutraSweet, and that's in a lot of artificial foods.
Right.
Some foods have high copper content, and there's people who are copper sensitive.
Yes.
A good way to test for that is to see if wheat germ gives you a migraine, because if it does, it's going to be the copper.
Right.
And then, of course, there are people who get MSG. Now, I mentioned vitamin B6, and the doses there, typically you start at 50 milligrams, and I have seen neurologists go as high as 300 or 400 milligrams, which is fine because it is a water-soluble vitamin. But I wouldn't recommend doing just B6 if you're doing those kind of doses.
Right.
I would make sure that all of my B vitamins were getting, you know, over-supplemented a little bit. I sort of figure if you throw all the B vitamins in there and stand back, in most individuals, the body will sort it out what it needs and pee out the rest.
Yeah.
Sometimes there are reports about fish oil capsules, but we're talking about EPA at really high doses, like 4 grams, 4,000 milligrams of EPA.
Then we have to worry about contamination, don't we,
well,
of the fish oil?
Not really. The higher quality fish oils are checked for mercury. They're extracted in a way that doesn't pull the mercury. It just pulls out the oil. So you can go to the website. You can go to consumerlab.com that does do mercury testing on all of the fish oil supplements and periodically publishes reports.
Right.
That one's not so much of an issue, actually, the mercury in fish oil.
Yeah.
Vitamin D and calcium have both been shown to help with migraines, and also magnesium. And magnesium is another one, like iodine, that is actually fairly low in our diet relative to what optimal levels probably are. And that has to do partially with processing, because a lot of the magnesium is processed out in any kind of food preservation method.
Is magnesium the one in green veggies or in whole grains?
Well, it's in both.
Or in everything.
Yeah, magnesium is pretty much omnipresent, but it's how it's how much. And yes, magnesium is in fresh fruits and vegetables, and the more you process it, the more you lose.
Yeah, no. Whatever I've done, it's working, so I'm being very careful, doing things, you know, very, very simply. Oh, and what do you feel about having walnut oil as a source of omega-3s instead of fish oil? And, like, balancing walnut oil with, say, grapeseed oil and almond oil instead of doing fish oils?
Well, I think you need to actually look up the EPA content.
Right.
Because the problem with the plant oils is that, okay, let me frame
this. Balance. There's something about
that. No, it's not that. It's a little more fundamental than that.
Oh, okay.
Omega-3 is a classification. When they call something an omega-3 fatty acid, that's a huge list of oils that qualify as containing omega-3 fatty acids. There is a absolutely specific fatty acid called EPA that works for migraines, according to the studies. And your body will take, like, for example, flaxseed oil is high in omega-3 fatty acids. But if you eat, say, a gram of flaxseed oil, you'll only make about 10 milligrams of EPA with it.
Right.
Because most of it doesn't get converted.
Oh, okay.
And so the problem is they sell it and they say, oh, it contains 2,000 milligrams of omega-3s.
Yeah.
And it does, but it's got 30 milligrams of EPA and you're trying to get to 400 or 4,000.
So how the body processes it.
Is huge, because these are foods, and the nature of foods is that these things that we are targeting and saying, okay, if we give a high level of this, we change the biological dynamic. This is nutrient as drug, and you need a high dose of any nutrient to get it to behave as a drug. Meanwhile, the body is sort of designed to be using nutrients as nutrients and producing a little bit of this quote-unquote drug-like substance as a byproduct, and it's not really important unless you magnify the amount, and that has to be done kind of artificially or in a biological system like a fish.
Well, all right, Dr. Don, I just wanted to toss that in because that was it was very, very interesting. There's so much information, and a lot of it, as they say, anecdotal about how people control their migraines.
I so very much appreciate your calling in and talking about how food and your headaches are related.
Oh, there's no question. By now, you know, I should know better, but I say I start feeling pretty good and forget about why I don't eat bananas.
Well,
thank you, Dr. Don.
You're very welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And we're going to go now and take another phone call. This from Jeff in Berkeley. Hello, Jeff, and welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you. Yes, thank you for your work, too. So I have PVC. I'm 46 years old. I was first diagnosed in my late 20s, just having flutters and feeling kind of weird about it, and I wore the holster monitor, and then again in my 30s, it seemed like it was a little more serious, and they said, no, it's fine. So now in my 40s, I've become a dad of twins, and my sleep is erratic because of the twins, and I'm also in grad school, and I noticed that those two things, by the fact that I'm kind of in a stressful environment in grad school, and that, you know, because of my boys, sleep is not consistent, that the PVCs are really acting up, and I don't know if that's a dangerous situation or, you know, because of my age and, you know, should I be checking this every decade or so? That's kind of my question.
All right. Well, to start with, premature ventricular contractions or PVCs are caused by a twitchy ventricle. a ventricle that has a low threshold, or at least a muscle cell within that ventricle of yours in your heart, has a low threshold to fire on its own, an independent-minded muscle cell, in other words. Yeah. And some people have a lower threshold for what's called ventricular irritability than others. It's undoubtedly something that's genetic, and maybe it's inherited or maybe it's acquired in utero, but either way, by the time you get to, say, 20 years old, it's kind of set in the cells. Now, a lot of things increase ventricular irritability. And back before we had clot busters and stents, when people had heart attacks, the lack of blood flow to the area of the heart, first of all, part of your heart would die with a heart attack, and then the part around it would be wounded. And the wounded heart muscle was very irritable, and it would throw out a lot of PVCs because the cells weren't working normally, and so they were throwing out a lot of these PVCs, and sometimes you would get a bunch in a row, and it would actually deteriorate into ventricular fibrillation, and you'd have to try to do a code blue on the person and get them back, and they might do that multiple times in the course of their hospitalization. And that was in the bad old days. Our cardiology intervention strategies and what we can do up front for people with heart attacks has vastly improved. And if you look at survival data, so has the survival data. But I think in many doctors' minds, there's this bad association with PVCs. And so it takes us a while to remember that some PVCs are worse than others.
Yeah.
And you have the benign variety. And so it's benign as long as your heart stays healthy otherwise. So cardiovascular disease, high cholesterol, sedentary lifestyle, those are the things you want to avoid. How's your family history for premature heart disease?
Well, it's not great, but I guess it's moderate. My grandfather died at 92 of a heart attack.
Well, he had to die of something, for goodness sakes.
Yes. But unfortunately now my uncle had a heart attack last year and my dad just had a valve replacement over the summer. So there is stuff going on there.
Valve replacement doesn't actually create risk for you. Your uncle's heart attack may. And
well,
if he's under,
he's got 9 stents too.
Okay.
So
you've got the DNA for that disease potentially. So as you get older and older, these PVCs, because they represent a stress on your heart, if they happen too frequently, could potentially feed into an arrhythmia of some kind that could become a medical problem. At this point, you've pinpointed your issues. Your issues are sleep deprivation and stress because you're in grad school. Okay.
Right.
How do you spell stress? Grad school.
Exactly.
G-R-A-D. Okay. Those being the case, what can you do about it? There's certain agents that are nutraceuticals that might lower your threshold for having your PVCs. Obviously, you need to get sleep. All right, so that's number one. To the extent that you don't sleep, you don't caffeine to make it through. And that's the...
I definitely don't use caffeine.
You can't use caffeine. You have to find some other way. So that's number one. Magnesium, I'm going to run through a bunch of things that are helping stabilize heart rhythm. Magnesium can help stabilize heart rhythm. Taurine, T-A-U-R-I-N-E, which is a non-essential amino acid. That's often used to stabilize heart rhythm. The doses is in grams, not milligrams. So you're really taking it as an amino acid. Mechanism is probably having something to do with serving as a substrate for the cardiomyocyte. In other words, the irritable cell is getting better nutrition, so it calms down a bit. So those are two things that are no harm, low level, worst case scenario, you get diarrhea or a little nausea from the amino acid. So low-level, low-risk interventions. You could go with those. Fish oil at higher doses. I know I sound like I've got stock in a fish oil company sometimes here, but omega-3 fatty acids, again, EPA, which is the one that has the most activity in the heart, probably looking at a dose of 2,000 milligrams.
Can I interject? I consume sardines. It's one of my favorite foods. I consume it regularly. I have it for lunch probably 3 to 4 times a week.
Check your urine mercury and make sure that's okay. Although sardines are smaller fish, so you're probably fine.
Yeah.
You're probably fine with that. And in terms of omega-3 content of sardines, that should be something you can look up fairly easily online. You know, so what's the average EPA content of a can of sardines or whatever volume you're eating and extrapolate out. I doubt you're coming anywhere close to 2,000 or 3,000 milligrams of EPA.
All right.
To get levels like that, we're really talking about a pharmaceutical level. It's kind of like the thing they say about the red wine, where you'd have to drink 15 bottles of red wine to get enough resveratrol to have it's one of those.
Right. I'm feeding fish oil to my kids, so I might as well start feeding it to myself.
Yeah, yeah. DHA in children makes them scary smart. So, of course, I don't know if you really want a scary smart set of twins. You may want to rethink that strategy.
No, if they're smarter, they're more they're better behaved, hopefully.
Oh, Jeff.
Yes.
That's such a lovely, naive, fatherly comment.
Well, you know, we want what's best for our kids, and if being smarter is at our own expense, I guess I'm willing to go that route.
Just get some sleep, man.
I know. You
might just really need to talk with the wife about, you know, doing trade-offs or something, just really so that only one of you is waking up to deal with the kids each night.
Yeah, I kind of mentioned the problem to her, and it wasn't the impetus for our conversation, but I just negotiated for earplugs like last week. So I'm headed in that direction.
Good.
So thank you so much for your help today.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Let me just suggest a reframing for you. Okay.
Yes.
Think of this as your smoke alarm. So your PVCs tell you when your stress levels have gotten to a toxic level.
Right.
And most of us just have to guess. Whereas you actually know when you're hurting your health and have to back off.
So is your opinion then that this is something I can manage lifelong, or will I have to get more watching it look closer when I'm older?
Your problem is if you develop coronary artery disease as what we call a comorbidity, then this is going to be a stressor. For example, let's suppose you lose part of your foot, or let's say you have a traumatic amputation at the ankle. This happens accidentally when you're 20. All right, so you're going to be fine. You get your prosthetic foot and you're doing really great until you develop hip arthritis on that side as a comorbidity. You didn't get the hip arthritis, let's say, because of the foot. But once you've got the hip arthritis, then the previous handicap of the foot starts to amplify the effect of the arthritis. So you've got something which is not really a problem in and of itself. You're getting by fine. Where it becomes a problem is if you also develop the cardiac comorbidity, which is all the more reason not to smoke, to exercise, to do the fish oil, and to keep your stress level down.
And sounds like cholesterol also.
Yeah, you got to watch that one.
Okay,
if that's
cool.
The reason that the family is getting the disease, then you'd want to be aggressive about your cholesterol levels.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bye bye.
And I didn't do this segue on purpose. Honest. It's totally random, but I've got this article right here that was going to be one of the things I talked about. So, hip exercise helping with people with knee arthritis. If you have knee arthritis, it is actually fairly important. In fact, maybe more important than exercising your knee muscles, to exercise your hip muscles. And this has to do with the fact that the knee has really concentrated the weight. So, for example, your body weight is distributed at the hips, you know, across an area the size of a large oval. And then when it gets down to your feet, it's distributed over, you know, an oval that is roughly, a third the size of your pelvis, two of those. So it's, you know, two-thirds of the body weight. But on the way down to the foot, you have the articular surface of the knee, which is a great deal smaller. It's basically the footprint of a coffee cup. And that has to hold 50% of your body weight when you're standing. And when you're walking, it has to hold all of your body weight. So it's a fourfold, at least, magnification. And as you can imagine, things grind down. But also, what's important to think about is if the weight hits that knee in a level fashion, comes on and comes off, that's one thing for wear and tear. But if it hits it sideways, or it hits it much harder on one side of the coffee cup than the other, or if it hits and then grinds or twists before it lifting off, all of those things are really going to aggravate the amount of inflammation. So this is a research-proven study. It came out of Rush University, and the investigating doctor is Dr. Thorpe. I don't actually have a reference for this, but it's published Rush University Medical Center, and the two investigators are Callahan and Thorpe. And the idea here is working the outside external hip muscles, so doing leg lifts, strengthens those muscles, And when you have strong muscles there, the weight as you walk moves much more evenly across your knee, doesn't grind or twist across the most vulnerable areas of cartilage. So whole leg exercises, including the hip, are very important for anyone with knee arthritis. Another issue is making sure that the foot and ankle are hitting the ground in an efficient way. So going to see someone who looks at your gait, who watches you walk, and I would basically indicate this as a quality indicator. If you go see an orthopedist for arthritis of your knee or a rheumatologist for arthritis of your knee, I think the hallmark of a good doctor would be someone who looked at your feet, checked your hips, and watched you walk. And if those three things didn't happen, then in my opinion, you haven't really had a full exam. So keep that in mind and go get a good book of general exercises and exercise those external hip muscles, lateral leg lifts, absolutely perfect, Jane Fonda and all of that. This is the field of burn that'll make you feel less pain in the long run. Let's go to Jocelyn in Aptos. Hello, Jocelyn.
Hi there.
Hi. What can I do for you?
Thanks for your show.
Thank you.
Well, I've had toenail fungus for over 3 years, and I've battled it by using the topical ointment.
Which one?
Fungicure.
All right, go ahead.
And I also really file it down quite a bit. And then finally I gave up last month and I went to my doctor because I didn't see any real results from that.
Mm-hmm.
And she prescribed terbinafine.
Right.
So I've been taking that for about a month. And I don't see a whole lot of change yet, but it's probably kind of early.
Are you taking it daily or are you taking it in bursts?
Daily.
Okay. It's going to take at least 3 months before you'll actually see a significant change in the toenails. It takes 6 months to grow new toenails.
Right.
And the damage is already done to the nails you can see.
Right.
So you won't see change for a while. Terbinafine does get in, this is Lamisil, and it does get into the nail itself,
mm-hmm.
penetrates it. So it'll make the nail toxic for the fungus. So the nail that you're growing now and the nail that you grow while you're on the drug in the future for the next 3 to 6 months will in fact be a better nail. It will be resistant to the fungus. And as soon as you are off of the drug, you'll have nice bomb-proof nail for another 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
Then at the end of a year, after you stop the drug, you'll have grown out that nail. You'll have your normal vulnerable nail again. And you will be re-exposed in your environment from your shoes, from your carpeting, maybe from your partner to the fungus. And whether or not it re-roots or not and starts growing in your toenail, well, it's a good bet that it will. So in the long run, you probably will want, once you get this cleared, which I would argue that you don't always need to clear toenail fungus, that, you know, and during beach season, a little nail polish will do the trick. And then in the winter, who cares?
Mm-hmm.
But for some people, they get thickening of the nail and it's painful. And
right.
that's a legitimate reason to treat it. If you do treat it, however, it's kind of a lifelong commitment.
Right.
And you,
oh, okay, because it keeps coming back.
It'll want to come back. The fact that you have it means you're vulnerable to it and it's in the environment.
Would I go back on that terbinafine at that point if it comes back?
You could. It's an extremely expensive agent, and it's also not easy on your liver.
That's what my next question was.
Well, like I said, I'm not sure you need to treat it in the first place.
Uh-huh.
You've made the assumption that you have a disease that needs treatment, and you know that, I think, is a rebuttable presumption if you're not having pain.
It's cosmetic, mostly.
If it's cosmetic, I think I would get some nail polish.
Okay.
Okay,
thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Let's go to Hallie in Santa Cruz. Hello, Hallie. Welcome to the program. Hi there.
Well, I don't know if this applies too well, but I'm 83, and I take a sleeping pill a doctor prescribed. At midnight, I got up for the bathroom, and the stairway is close by, and I sort of staggered into it and fell headfirst down 14 carpeted steps.
Oh, my God.
I didn't break anything. I went the next day to the hospital and had an x-ray, which is, of course, fantastic. And so I tried to tell myself it was all lucky. But at first, it was excruciating if I coughed or sneezed or moved the wrong hand or reached with the wrong hand. It showed that the whole muscle I've forgotten the name of it, but the muscle from the hip to the armpit on the left side was strained.
Mm-hmm.
And but now, every day there seems to be a new sore place.
When did you fall? How long ago?
It was a week ago yesterday.
All right.
At midnight.
So from this standpoint, by now you should have... Most of the injuries that you've made should have demonstrated themselves and be talking to you. Now,
sure.
The other thing is that as you move in a funny way, because part of you hurts, you may overstress additional parts of your body. So it's not unusual, for example, like I was saying with the person, if your foot's wrong, it hurts your knee, or if your hip's wrong, it hurts your knee. If you're walking in an odd way or sitting in an odd way, the opposite, the part of your body that's being overused as a result, may start talking to you. But it'll start talking to you in a kind of dull, achy way, not in a sharp way. And that should fade within a few days. The other thing I wanted to say before I let you do your follow-up question is the one thing that can show up to a month or two after such an injury, and the thing that I would, if I were your treating physician, I would sort of flag your chart and talk to a family member or friend and say, if she starts acting funny, like forgetful, we're doing a head scan again. Because you can have something called a chronic subdural. You have a head crunch, and maybe you're not even knocked out. Maybe you just get a bonk on the head. But a month or two later, you'll start to act like you're demented. And at your age, people might just figure, oh, here comes the Alzheimer's. It's important that somebody who's close to you knows that if you start behaving like you have Alzheimer's, because you don't, you're 80 and you're clear as a bell, then they need to do a head scan. Okay? What's your follow-up?
I'm so glad you told me that, because I would have thought, here I go.
Yeah, no.
I plan to take myself out when that happens. Now, I mean, I didn't have generalized pain. It was just those sharp, like you mm-hmm. put it, sharp reactions. But now, like my whole back.
Right.
One big ache.
Yeah, and that's the compensation.
And it also
yeah.
moved. It also moved to my buttock.
Yep. Well, I think that if you don't have any heart conditions, obviously you told me you're not on any meds and you do see physicians. So you
I am on heart meds.
Oh, you are on heart meds. Okay. You should talk with the person who's prescribing the heart meds about this advice then, to be sure that it's okay to apply in your case. In general, however, warm baths and using like Epsom salts are nice for this kind of muscle achiness, and light massage if you have the discretionary income to go and get a massage at one of the many local massage places in a neighborhood near you. That can be really helpful in mobilizing this discomfort. It could be very helpful for you.
Thank you so very much.
You're welcome, and have a great day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
When you're 83, every day is a great day.
Yeah, every day is a gift. By the way, maybe a little gate across the top of that stairway?
Okay.
Okay. All right. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. And let's talk to Sean in Santa Cruz. Hello, Sean, and welcome to the show.
Hello, Dr. Don.
Good morning.
I was actually a student of yours at Five Branches a few years ago.
Oh, okay. Which one were you?
I was Sean Smolinski.
Okay, yes, I placed you. Go ahead.
Yes. Let me see. I wanted to make a comment about just kind of the migraine discussion that you've been having today.
Go ahead.
And it's to put it out there that cranial sacral therapy may be of benefit to some of those folks who suffer from that affliction, because of the it can help with blood flow and regulating blood flow to the head. I've seen just marked changes in my patients using cranial sacral work before and after in terms of like rosiness of
right.
complexion.
You know, that's one of the things that cranial sacral is, to me, sort of up there with homeopathic in that
yeah.
I totally do not get the cognitive model, and I wish that it could be more generally applied. Both of these seem very subject and practitioner dependent, which makes them extremely difficult to validate through our current scientific model. That being said, there's a published paper in this month's Alternative and Complementary Medicine on cranial sacral and TMJ.
Oh, cool, yeah.
Which I thought was very interesting. And
yeah.
In
yeah.
at least some cases, you know, anything you can do, and I don't really care if it's placebo, if it keeps somebody off of the operating table,
exactly.
It's a really good idea.
Yeah, and it's also, you know, like the whole, the other thing I was going to call in just about the migraine thing, but then when you started talking about hips and knees, that's just right there too, you know, and the whole connection between joints and how it can just travel, like you say in Chinese medicine, up the channels, move through the body that way, some sort of pain syndrome.
And for the more scientifically oriented out there who are thinking, oh, these people are talking garbage, I'll just point out that you can affect the sympathetic nervous system, and that can actually be measured by things like pulse velocity and galvanic skin response and other nice scientific sorts of independent measures. And when you apply those and use craniosacral techniques, you can see changes in hand temperature, changes in galvanic skin response. So
you can establish
that the therapy is touching the system. Whether or not that touching of the system is what's operating the cure, much harder to establish, and also whether it's generalizable, again, very difficult. But at least in terms of saying there is a mechanism here, that can be established. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was going to say, and on top of that, it works with the premise that the body is tending towards self-correction if you give it that opportunity. So when a person works with intention on the body, say in the hip area or with the sacrum, it can affect those soft tissues that run between the hips and the knees and can release those restrictions or what have you, and can help, you know, work with those joints to open them up and affect change throughout the body.
I wanted to just comment on something. Do you have one last point before I
just a short point, but I wanted to ask you a question for you, actually.
Uh-huh.
I heard this week that there was a sharp spike kind of around the world in the H1N1 deaths. And I wanted to ask you if you had a comment about that. And also, is there any kind of information out there about those who have gotten very sick or died and whether they were or were not vaccinated? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. And I want to point out that when you're in the middle of a car race, you don't have a bird's eye view to know whether you're ahead or not.
Sure, yeah, it's hard to assimilate all the data.
And the quality of the data, the quality of your point of view, and the validation techniques that you're using are all up in the air. So that question can't be answered right now. And when there's a spike in reporting data, that can mean that somebody just got back from vacation and finally finished processing all of the reports on their desk, or it could actually mean that there's an increase. And the problem is there's so many variables and questions. We do not have an ability to give the people the real-time concrete analysis that they want.
So those people may not have actually died this last week. That's kind of what you're saying?
Or more people died the week before and they all got glommed into 1 week.
Sure.
And
yeah, okay.
Okay,
yeah,
so sure. You can't draw conclusions from this. This is such...
I typically try not to.
Buzzy. Well, the newspapers are just reporting these things as if all of these factoids were validated and meaningful, and that's simply not the case. We should all just take a deep breath and wait for the dust to settle, because whatever it is, it is. And you're going to have to make your decision about vaccinate, don't vaccinate on bad and inadequate information and take your best shot. And then in a year or two, then I'll be able to Monday morning quarterback it and tell you whether you should have gotten vaccinated or whether the whole thing was just a tempest in a teapot. You know, as far as vast conspiracy on the part of vaccine manufacturers and the government, let's go talk about other vast conspiracies. There's plenty to discuss. But
well, I'm not
just
really,
not
you know,
to,
trying to be conspiratorial.
Oh, I know you're
just,
not.
I'm not attributing
that to you. Don't
okay.
get me wrong. I'm just saying we can't use this information in the way that you've framed your question. Just to get back to validation, this is actually relevant in an indirect way. You have to decide how you're going to validate information. Mm. And in the case of deaths from H1N1, do we count people who died who wouldn't have died otherwise, but who had H1N1, or people who were on their deathbed or close to it
and got it in the
intensive care unit where their survival was problematic to start with? And do you count that as half a death or a 10% death? Or do you count it as a full-on death, even though if
they do that?
No, they don't. Huh. So it counts as a death. But, you know, realistically, attributable or just coincident? You see the point. Whenever you really start to try to get down to this, the numbers fade and they run like sand through your fingers. With validation, though, on our previous comments about craniosacral and homeopathic, and I would add to that acupuncture, although, of course, you're fully believe in acupuncture as a validated method since you've studied it, but the general population plus the government plus the health plans, you know, it's still a debatable point.
Sure.
And the point I want to make that I think is really fun is if we get national health care, then how are we going to validate things? Are we going to validate them as scientifically improved survival? Or are we going to say, well, it has to be improved survival at a certain cost? Or does it have to be lowers our costs? The Germans, very practical people, have done lots of studies on acupuncture, and they've been unable to prove that acupuncture is statistically different from placebo acupuncture in terms of pain scores or any other scientific validated measure of pain. On the other hand, the people that they treated with acupuncture in their study groups had lower overall costs to the German healthcare system, which is an integrated system. So they decided to pay for
it. They did get better faster.
Well, it means they spent less money. And so whether they got better or not from a personal standpoint, from the government's point of view, that was much better because they didn't cost as much. So they pay for it because it lowers their overall cost, which I think is fascinating because that's a different standard of proof. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Is it effective as an budget effective? Anyway, it's an interesting point when you talk about validation. What is valid?
True.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Appreciate the call. Bye-bye.
Happy Saturday.
Well, we've come to the end of another hour, and the clock on the clubhouse wall tells us that it's time to go out into the big wide world until next week. Until then, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.